when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the culture we love that society sometimes makes us feel ashamed of. My name is Caroline and this is Wake Up with Phlegm.
Already obsessed.
Joining me is a returning guest who is also going to be returning her Design by Mag lamp.
Naomi Albert.
Design by Mag.
That was the most last minute prop department decision
they
ever.
They really ran out of road by that point. Designed by Mag.
Just chucking in at the very... Oh, she's a lamp designer.
Generally all the names, like Maggie Carpenter. Yeah. Oof. Because she's, you know, works with her hands.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel catatonic about the fact that Richard Gere's, he's a journalist, and his cat's called Italics.
I just noticed that on my third rewatch of the year was last night.
I'm on number three.
So it's funny, this film, Runaway Bride, it is... We've definitely got a yen on this podcast for the noble failures of Julia Roberts.
Yeah.
Of which they are the most interesting films of her body of work to me. Like, I love Erin Brockovich. I love her big, meaty work. But the stuff I get more interested in is, like, when the woman who can do no wrong misfires slightly, I find it fascinating. The other one we covered here was Mona Lisa Smile, which I adore.
Yes.
But is laggy and weird. Yeah. And, like, there are some fucking weird performances and weird choices, but I still love it. And Runaway Bride is laggy as hell.
Yeah.
Weird choices. Feels very, what's not formulaic, but, you know, just very
premisey.
Very premisey. That's
it's
the word for
premise-y.
It. And yet I love it so much.
Same.
And when I found out you loved it as well, I was like, oh, this is one of the reasons why.
I think it's one of the great.
It's one of the
great. I way prefer it to Pretty Woman,
me
controversially.
Too. Yeah.
And actually, I think we, Caroline and I, have gone so hard in on working out, like, what is it that makes this film in at moments incredible, but overall, like, quite terrible. And I think the characters are... rock solid.
Yeah.
Some of the motivations of the characters aren't rock solid, which we will return to, namely Maggie and her commitment phobia.
Yeah.
But I like those characters of that Americana world. Mm. They feel believable to me. That journalist feels believable to me. I think the premise is great about a woman who keeps bolting from commitment. The problem is plot and pacing.
It's pacing. And it's such an indefinable thing. When we were doing the And Just Like That podcasts, we talked a lot about steps on the stairs and what happens when there are too many missing steps and you can't get your way all the way up the stairs, and the idea of, like, missing hard drives and just, like, that feeling that... And I find it so, I don't know, something so fundamentally a part of the human experience, in that we have been telling each other stories, like since we could speak.
Mm.
Like, even pre-language, we've been... telling each other stories, and, like, the idea that there comes a feeling when you are watching a film or reading a book where you're like, no,
yes,
there's a no that comes upon the human soul that is universal, and there are professions, including this one, based on, like, pivoting on the fact where did the no happen, you
exactly
know?
Yeah. That, and I still get it, like, even though, how long is this movie? It's 2 hours long.
It feels so long.
And we basically think the first hour is perfect, don't we?
Yeah, a perfect rom-com that could easily slot into, like, one of the great sort of Nora Ephron-y type things. The script is beautiful. The performance is beautiful. That town is wonderful to just sit and live in.
Yeah, although you won't go visit it with me.
We'll get to that.
I'm so glad we're finally having this out. Because it got really spicy back there a few months ago. We were talking about this. Anyway, we'll return.
It did. I actually regret some things I said.
Okay,
we'll return to it.
The town is lovely. The precinct is lovely.
Yeah.
But the people are believable. Even the whole setup, like, I have to say, I know it's kind of corny, but I love the journalist desperately looking for a story.
Yeah.
I think he writes a daily column, we're meant to believe. And that is such a thing that we all understand of what is it to keep finding inspiration when you're not writing about yourself and you're writing about other people. I like him being in a dive bar and some like drunk guy with a story giving him the story. It's corny as hell and I love it.
But also it feels very real and very that place in time. And like, I think as, you know, I would struggle to call both of us journalists now, but we're certainly...
I don't think I could ever call myself a journalist. Like, it's quite silly. I've got to take that off all my bios.
Yeah, I dropped journalist. It as well. Just because, I think you and I, when we were writing for like either paper, I mean, you still write for a magazine weekly with an Agony Aunt column, but like... when we were both doing a lot of like digital content.
800 words on the pros and cons of wearing gloves. Thank you, the debrief.
Like, if somebody, there are many other people that follow that career directory, and I'm sure they call themselves journalists and they're fine with it and they feel totally legitimate that it all has a place in the great, you know, sanctum of the written word. But when I was doing it, I felt very weird about calling myself a journalist. But we find it very, very romantic, that thing of like, just being in a bar, and the idea that like, there was a time, there was a version of New York not so long ago, but is now definitely dead, where like, you know, they cut the string off the top of the of the pile of papers and they throw them out and New York is waking up and the sunlight's coming up and people are going to work and people are working hard and they're reading their paper and they're flipping it out and, you know,
it makes me so horny, that montage.
So horny for the written word.
I love it. That thing of like Cosmo Landisman, who wrote my dating column with me, who's in his 60s and he's been a journalist since he was in his 20s. I sometimes get him to talk to me about what that golden era of journalism was like, and he said it was like, you know, that bit in the montage of Runaway Bride where the guys, it's so exciting, Ike's column is so exciting that the guys printing it
are taking it off the machine like hot like a bun.
And he said it was like that. He said that it felt like a good newspaper or magazine column when it came out felt like a pop record coming out and everyone rushing to the record store. And there is something about that guy, and particularly I really like everyone reading his column, that kind of city being alight with his unbelievably misogynistic column that opens the whole...
That now, even though the excitement and the physicality of like, the city is awake and they're all reading like...
Oh no, it's... I can
It's very familiar.
It. Yeah.
It's so familiar now. Like, the behaviour is different in terms of now it's people just reading an article on their phone if they can get past the paywall or not, and then tweeting about it or whatever. But the journalism and the prose is shockingly familiar.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I kind of felt like it was a bit Jeremy Clarkson.
It's kind of, that's what I felt. It's like kind of this weird spot between Gerald Corin and Jeremy Clarkson.
Yeah.
Of just like a guy who doesn't know a lot but has a certain sort of turn of phrase that people respond to rightly or wrongly.
And can cloak his misogyny in this kind of like cerebral, mythological allegory that is like, you know, biting, caustic humour. Really familiar, I think.
And like more popular now than ever, oddly. And it's so funny because I think rom-coms of this era are obsessed with journalists because, for many reasons, mostly that they're... just an easy way to get someone in and out of a situation. Why do we need to put this fish out of water? Because they're working on a story. It's the how to lose a guy in 10 days, it was all for some article the whole time kind of thing. It's really lovely. But generally, the prose itself is not recognizable. It'll be like that great sort of rom-com convention of like, when I started writing this article... it was to discover blah, 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 blah. But I ended up discovering myself. And then you'll see all these women in... Wow. Like, I always think about the 13 going on 30 denouement where Jennifer Gardner, she does this big pitch.
Oh, the revamp.
The revamp pitch to her like very shiny fashion magazine she works as. Like, what if the magazine was about us? And just pictures of all of them. And I was like, this is not it.
And she's been working on it for weeks. I would love to know, like, of my journalism masters that I did, I would have done that in 2009. So as definite millennial child of the 90s, I would love to know if these rom-coms that are based in magazine offices and newspaper offices.
Yeah.
I wonder how much, if they didn't exist, how fewer people would have been on that master's course.
Do you know what? And the thing is, the right people would have become journalists instead
not
of
people
the wrong
like you
ones,
and I.
Like you and I, who were just using it as like, who don't love the news, who crucially don't love the news, who don't care about the truth, and who are so-so about justice.
We don't care about the truth.
We just wanted a platform to launch our own Carrie Bradshaw's life, and I think we did pretty well.
We did it, baby. Here we are, hard-hitting reporters.
This is already very rogue.
Anyway, so it. Ike, yes.
Yeah.
He's believable. I agree with you.
Yeah,
even that like depressing old Miles Davis obsession and the
oh god, the cat called italics.
The cat called 100%. Italics. He's a familiar journalistic figure to me. If he were in real life, he would have a cocaine problem.
Yeah.
If he wasn't in like a rated 12 rom-com,
absolutely.
He'd have a massive cocaine problem and like a permanently open tab at the Groucho. He's so familiar to me, that journalist.
Yeah, totally. Even like the kind of the cool boy Vice journalist that you meet every so often in London life, there's a kind of a strain of that still present.
Yeah.
There's something, the male opinion columnist who so probably also feels like he should be a political reporter and should care about the news, but crucially does not.
Ike does not care
about
the
news. It's the male Carrie Bradshaw, really. It's like,
yes,
what does that
totally.
Look like? It looks like Ike going to a dive bar in the middle of the day, chatting up a girl and not going so well, and then him writing a column about it, being like, I've been accused of, you know, using this column to further female stereotypes, but I think the exact wording is, but how can I not deal in female stereotypes when they're all around me all the time? Like, that is a Carrie Bradshaw intro, isn't it? Premise. And then
this
it goes,
is great. Ike is the male Carrie Bradshaw.
Yeah, and it's horrible.
Also, I find it really interesting then the way that they use his job as a way to kind of reflect Maggie's deep wounds back to her. Like the thing that is so similar about these two characters that we're meant to believe by the end is that they're both terrified of being vulnerable. So with Maggie, it's like she has this thing about she won't commit to someone because, in my opinion, she can't kind of commit to herself and the version of herself that she can make peace with. Whereas with him, when she does that speech, she's working very hard with quite a poor script at that point, I think, that speech.
The wheels come off that script.
That's when after that party, I think that's when it starts getting a bit, after the Hawaiian party.
Yeah,
it's
weird because the luau is the best part of the movie and everything after that is basically trash.
Yeah, it could almost end at him defending her.
Yeah.
It's good role.
Yeah.
And she could fuck off without anyone and that would have been perfect.
Yeah.
But that she gives that speech and she says to him, you know, I'm not the only one that's lost. And something she says is, which is often something targeted at journalists, particularly that type of journalist, is she said, I've read all your columns and you don't talk about yourself at all. So you have defaulted to cynicism and criticism, and you have made your personality and your livelihood out of tearing other people down and making fun of people because you're so scared of actually presenting who you are to the world. So I think it's believable that that's their like shared core wound, that they don't want to be themselves, basically.
I think that's really smart.
Yeah.
And like way smarter than the average good rom-com. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like if we think of, like you said Pretty Woman a minute ago, and obviously that is a natural comparison because this was, you know, 5 or 6 years after Pretty Woman, but it was like what everyone was excited about, seeing these two actors get back together. There's amazing chemistry. And also, we'll get to in a little while, the sense of Julia Roberts' own love life had been such a thing of public speculation. She had famously jilted Kiefer Sutherland 3 days before their wedding. And it's like you look at a quote unquote good rom-com like Pretty Woman, where all of the parts are in place. How whatever you think about its treatment of sex work, you can't sort of, and it is a very judgmental film about that and very narrow, you can't deny that it's just fucking fun and it just works and it's sexy and but like it's not saying anything
about
life, about women, about men. It is a simple Cinderella story with sort of a 90s LA twist.
Yeah.
But this is a movie that is trying to say things about people and how people are, and which is why I find it to be such a noble failure. Because you're right, it identifying in a kind of a very popcorn-y rom-com that like the core wound in our two main characters is that they are do not know who they are.
Yeah.
And that is a very hard thing to put on screen in a very basic rom-com.
Totally.
And it struggles with it. And the other thing is that, like, this thing it routinely comes back to, which is like, why does she bolt? Why does she bolt? And it's what he sort of like gets to in his investigation of her is she is somebody who is so lacking in identity that they just merge with whoever they're with.
Yeah.
And also this thing of like, they're so, that character is so lovable, so mysterious, so sexy, so everything that you want a woman to be, that women want to be, that men want to be with, that they could have a power that is intangible even to themselves.
Mm.
Like, they're able to come alive with people, but they're not able to make their own life come alive.
Yes, exactly.
And there's something tragic and beautiful about that.
And something that's so fluid about that, that you feel like Maggie could make anyone fall in love with her, which does not mean being lovable.
Yeah.
That doesn't, if you're someone who you know that you can say the right things or do the right things or, you know, wear the right clothes and that people will be drawn to you, that isn't having this like core understanding, like her best friend, the Joan Cusack character, like that someone deeply knows and loves you.
Yeah.
So it can, I think that character is like deeply insecure despite being the person that everyone wants to be friends with and everyone wants to marry. Interestingly, something that you said to me about like the thing that you think is like the key to that character and the key to the whole story about like, why does she run? Is, the thing about like she doesn't know who she is, and that's demonstrated with the eggs. Every person she's with, she wants a different type of eggs. So today I read that, and you said they're so near like really exploring that and paying that off properly with the plot rather than the way they do it with the wedding that doesn't happen and then the proposal. Interestingly, that was written in afterwards. So they wrote that entire script and that film on the premise of she runs.
Yeah.
And no one knew why. So that was drafted in of like, oh, we need to work out why the women on screen need to have psychology. Guess what? They wrote that in as a last minute amendment.
Wow.
Which is why it feels like it's so near brilliance, but so unexplored.
So this is it. To get into that, it's she wants scrambled eggs with one guy, she wants poached with another guy, she wants whatever. She wants an egg white only omelette with her weird fitness man. And then he has this confrontation with her and he just kind of says, you don't know who you are, you're just, you know, she says there's such a thing as changing your mind, and he said, no, that's having no mind at all.
Yeah.
And it's like a very charged scene, and we'll talk about it a bit more when we kind of get chronologically through it. But then, and you're like, oh my God, this film is on the edge of like really understanding something about women and the way we gamify romance to ourselves.
Yes.
And the way we like, in order to get swept up into our own narrative and to do the things that are equate to winning in female culture,
yes,
to have someone fall in love with you, to have them propose to you, to have a wedding in front of all of your friends, which is basically what she's doing. Like, she's a scholarship kid who never got to take the scholarship because she had to look after her dad, and now she's using romance as sort of a way of like underlining her own existence or like verifying her own existence. It's like, oh my God, you've got something there.
Yeah.
You've got something. And then it pulls back and he's like, you deserve a man who will cover your eyes while you walk on the beach so you can feel the sand under your feet. And she's like, wow. It's like, no, nothing sand, nothing eyes.
I hate
that bit. No.
It doesn't help that Richard Gere just leaves me dry as a bone, I must say. I don't
really?
All those characters he plays. Do you fancy Ike?
I don't not fancy him. In the same way, I don't not fancy Matthew McConaughey in all of his rom-com roles, but I'm glad to see him in, I guess.
But
you know?
Matthew McConaughey's like a bit of get up and go.
Yeah.
There's something about Richard Gere in all of his performances that I find so depressing and low-key. When he does that speech about the walking on the beach, I'm like, oh, it sounds like a funeral dirge.
Yeah, when he's being romantic and sincere.
Yeah.
He's good when he's a slimy character, but when he's trying to do sort of romantic sincerity, it does not work.
Doesn't work for me. Doesn't do it for me.
You should. It should be the kind of guy that you fall in love with because he's a bit of an arse and you sort of love that about him rather than, and here's my soft inner side.
No, I think in rom-coms she's having to work her arse off to bring all that romance and magic. So I just personally don't think he does. But anyway, yeah. Yes, you're right that that speech, it feels like totally counterproductive to the fundamental point that's just been made.
Yes. And like what I, so to go back to sort of like chronologically go through the movie, he writes this thing about her and then she, you know, meanwhile, in her small town, first she thinks it's like a joke that's been like planned by her bridesmaids, like a fake newspaper, which I find very heartbreaking. And then she's so angry that she writes a letter to the editor, and it's a really well done bit of, you know, a furious actress typing and writing.
Yeah.
Of being like, you know, I would have thought that facts were important. You know, here are some mistakes. There are 15, and then they fire him based on not checking his facts, which doesn't feel huge celebrity columnist who everyone's excited about, disgraced by one letter to the editor from someone that no one knows. All right.
Okay.
Fine. Movies. He then is like, oh, well, I'll do a massive investigatory feature on her. I'll go to her hometown. I'll like talk to everybody she knows. Mm. And this is another fascinating part of the movie for me, because I think this is the point where it becomes like a psychological horror.
Yeah. 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 When you said that to me, when we first started talking about this,
it
suddenly I saw the film in such a different way through her eyes. It's an exploration of like negative parasocial relationships before pre-internet, and anyone who's ever had like, I've experienced this, it's very, very strange when you feel like there are people that you don't know who are obsessed with you in a negative way, fixated on you, that they hate you, they have an idea of like who you are or what you represent or what your story is, and they've never met you, and they're not like, you know, misogynist trolls telling you that you're a fat slut or whatever, which is horrible in its own way. But this is like a particularly chilling thing.
Like a thinking person. Like
a thinking person who you would otherwise like respect and listen to. And they can't, it feels like they cannot stop thinking about you. And you don't know where this like, their pursuit of like bringing you down or trying to expose something about you, whatever, that it's relentless. It's so frightening and horrible and weird. I'm lucky that it hasn't happened to me that much, but it has, and you've had to like, you know, watch me go through that. And you said to me, there was one particular person, you said, imagine if they moved to your hometown, befriended everyone you loved and convinced everyone you loved that they were a really good person.
It's hard, and that
it's
is
horrifying.
Why I, because I've always liked this movie, but I hadn't seen it in years, and then I threw it, like, it came on Disney Plus. I threw it on some hungover morning, and that is like after seeing people who would, you would otherwise think would be thinking people come after one of my best friends in a like relentless and sort of almost like pseudo intellectual way of like, let's really think about the problem with Dolly Huggins. She's not doing anything.
She's writing about gloves.
and like you're having to like see like one of the people you love best in the world like go through that kind of onslaught. Then the, I hope this is a little very exposing for you.
No, I don't mind actually.
And then I watched it and I was like, imagine if that person showed up and somehow convinced everyone that Dolly knows and grew up with and her parents and her grandma that like actually, you know, he's a really like nice guy to have around, fun dude, and like, and it begins with everyone's like, oh, Maggie, he, you know, just like give him what he wants and he'll go away, kind of thing. And then he just ingratiates, he's going to sports games, he's like jamming with people
and like gaining their trust. That's the thing that I think is really frightening, is that he's gaining their trust and he's accessing the interior and intimate life of his. It's like it's like an assailant, you know. It's like that. It's like, so it's like he is gaining as much information and proximity and closeness as possible to his victim. And actually, after you said that, I looked up what the rules, because I've obviously never written psychological horror. Psychological thrillers. I looked at what the rules of those, like the fundamental pillars of those,
what makes
stories
something
are
a psychological thriller. Right.
Yeah, and it's a lovable but flawed hero or heroine.
Yeah,
which is who Maggie is.
Yeah,
it is a likable villain, a complicated likable villain. It is a palpable threat, which is obviously the threat, I think, is that he's going to ruin this wedding. That's what it feels like, that this wedding is not going
to
happen.
And he's also, he's trying to get in her head. Like, he's, he's trying, like, he's, everything she does, she's questioning. She's making her, he's making her question how she is with her friends, how she is with her friends' husbands, how she is with her family. Why is she here? And it's like, he and like, there's her fiance kind of says to her, like, oh, he's just trying to get in your head. But, like, the fact, like, why is no one listening to her?
It is horrible.
You know?
And then there's, and then the other rule is that there has to be, obviously, an enormous twist. And the enormous twist is she befriends her assassin. She falls in love with her assassin. Like, that's the big twist. I do think that there is something quite horrifying about this film. Yeah. That bit when he has the naked photograph of her.
That's very... That does not hold up. No. Well, many things don't hold up. And that's why it's like, its status as a noble failure is much more interesting and exciting to me than anything that, like, a slick piece of machinery that just works.
Yeah.
He basically goes and he questions all of her exes, which, like, imagine. Imagine someone who has assassinated you once in the press with no research, and then plans to research it for a second piece in which they assassinate you again. Then talking to all of your exes.
It's so strange. It's so... I always remember listening to an interview with Dawn French, I think it was, where she said the only reason why she had to start talking about her personal life was that a biographer started writing a book about her. So this is something that anyone can do, that no permission needs to be sought.
Yeah.
So, like, this is what he's doing in journalistic form, because, as we know, what's that phrase he says? Journalism is literature in a hurry. But he's he's writing a biography of this woman without her consent. And it is like something that happens. Imagine that happening to you. It really scares me. I don't like it.
I don't like it. But it's interesting, the sort of meta conversation of this film, which is, so in the 90s, Julia Roberts is like a climb to fame. Incredibly swift, like literally she leaves school at 17. She goes directly to New York to be an actor. She very quickly gets Mystic Pizza, which is like this huge breakout. And then, you know, there's like one, two, three roles kind of thing that just kind of in about 2 years, by the time she's like 21, 22, makes her the most famous woman in the world. She is engaged to the actor Dermot Mulroney, I think.
Yes.
Breaks it off after a year or so. You'll give her that. You know, she's 22. Who cares? Then she gets engaged to Kiefer Sutherland. Then several weeks before their wedding, he is caught photographed with a go-go dancer. And that's a bit, and it becomes poor Julia, poor Julia, poor Julia. Then a week before the wedding, she is apparently at like a girls' spa in like a girls' spa weekend type thing.
That, did she cancel it at the spa?
Well, then
those birds with a drunk wine got in her ear.
I know. So then Jason Patrick, who was Kiefer Sutherland's best man, suddenly shows up at the spa weekend.
This is insane.
I know. I couldn't believe it. Because, like, I think this happened like 92. So we would have been too young to, like, obviously have known the press at that time. And it's the sort of life of Julia Roberts has gone on so much that we never really talk about this anymore. So Jason Patrick, who is an up and coming actor and the best friend and best man of Kiefer Sutherland, shows up at the spa weekend where she's really upset still because of the Kiefer Sutherland cheating on her, whatever. And then 3 days before the wedding, press release comes out, they're cancelling the wedding. By the way, they were going to get married on the Fox lot.
That's so bizarre.
I know. And her maid of honour was her makeup artist. Her bridesmaid was her agent.
Bless her. That's such a young, famous person's story.
I know. God love her, like.
God love her.
But then the story became Julia Bolts. Julia Bolts. And then she then went to Dublin, which I like, with Jason Patrick.
You know every beat of the story. Like, I literally... Day to day.
Actually, I'm getting all this from the Shameless podcast, which is these two Australian birds who are very nice.
I love them. Yeah,
really good. So then they kind of have a very short-lived romance together, and then quickly she moves on and whatever. But the story so quickly became Julia bolts. Julia bolts. Why is Julia bolting? Two engagements, one called off 3 days before the wedding. Mm. But it's like, and kind of papers over the fact that Kiefer Sutherland cheated on her with the dancer.
Yeah,
and that was
yeah.
the original story.
Yes.
And so what I find so interesting about Runaway Bride is it happens a couple of years after that, and it's in active conversation with a story about Julia that was already happening at the time. I think after the Kiefer Sutherland Jason Patrick thing, there was also, you know, a very short wedding to Lovett, and it's like everyone was like, this is the most beautiful, charming girl in the world.
Yeah.
And every time you see her on screen, she has this ineffable quality where you feel like, and this is the magic of her, you feel like you're watching the core of her, you know. Mm. There's this like stillness and this like naturalness that you can so, it's just good skill, but you can so easily mistake for, I see her and I get her.
Yeah, totally.
And the fact that she was doing things that no one could get just made this weird mystery around her that plays right into the mystery of Maggie.
I didn't know all that. I knew that she had, you know, cancelled a wedding very shortly before, but I do think that there is no way that is not some sort of like retort or exploration or like, and I do find it very chic when actors do that.
I love it. And sometimes it,
rather than sitting and doing some like poor me interview, I just think that's like such a fabulous way of saying, by the way, I'm much more self-aware than you think I am.
Yes, exactly. And you know what? It's rarely received well, because the other version I'm thinking about is the Jennifer Aniston making The Breakup.
Yeah. Oh, I love that movie.
I really like it too. And it's another like weird noble failure. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't really work. It feels fucking long.
Yeah.
But there are scenes in it that you're like, wow, this is like this actor talking directly to me.
Oh,
about
definitely.
Their experience, you
definitely.
Know?
It's so strange as well to think that Julia Roberts was 32 when she did this movie. And I remember very clearly when it was out in the cinemas as it being
the horrible poster of her with the runners
with
on.
The big trainers.
I hate them.
The big clumpy trainers. That this was her comeback. This was like a comeback movie.
Oh my God.
Isn't that crazy? Should I mean the younger than me?
Her comeback. And now it's like regarded as this funny little blip in like a huge career.
Yeah.
I wish every actress could have that career. Do you know what I mean? When I think of like, you know, the Winona Ryders of this world who gave the world so much in such a short amount of time and then she stole a few bags and then I was like, no thank you.
Yeah.
Forever. Thank you for your service. Goodbye. Like, you know, it just makes you think how few actresses are given that longevity and that
totally
chance. You know?
It's interesting that thing you said about the Julia Roberts quality, because something I didn't really fixate on what that thing, she's just so a part of like rom-com furniture to me, and I just, it feels like comfortable to watch her, and she's gorgeous and she's sweet and funny and whatever, but there is a one in a million magic with her. I think Meg Ryan has it as well, of like when we were casting my TV show and we were looking for the lead actor, I remember China, my director, because she was so hard to find, that actor, we cast Emma Appleton in the end. I remember China, we had to have so many meetings with all the networks, and China kept saying, we need to find someone with a Julia Roberts quality, which is like someone who makes you fall in love with her, with like a big smile, who is, you know, attractive enough to like lead a TV show in the world that we live in, but who has like a quality to her that is just adorable, lovable, and not cloying and not annoying. And she is never annoying. Julia Roberts plays fucking annoying characters, and she's never annoying.
It is this weird gold dust, isn't it? And I thought about your show a lot when I was rewatching it again last night. Obviously, the name of the character is, was that intentional?
No.
Just
no.
Maggie is like,
I know. Monica and I have discussed this.
Yeah. Because Monica Heisey's book, really good actually. The heroine is Maggie.
Yeah.
Your heroine is Maggie. This heroine. There's something about that name.
I know.
And it's funny because it's like it communicates a lot about a person. And I'm always fascinated by character names in general. It's like somebody whose long name is definitely Margaret.
Yeah.
And so therefore comes from a kind of a suburban, probably quite middle class, old fashioned world, who is friendly and soft and is called Maggie, but also is like dynamic enough to go by a short thing. You know, there's like something in it. You know?
Anything that ends with an E, I think, is always really like it gives you warm feelings towards that character. I always, particularly in ensembles, even in books, I'm thinking about how many E's there are. But Monica and I,
this may be too inside baseball, but Monica and I have already decided that there needs to be one more story with a millennial woman called Maggie whose life is falling apart, and there's going to be some horrible opinion piece, the title of which we've decided will be What's Wrong With All The Maggies? Or so, What's The Matter With Maggie?
What's and, the matter with
and
Maggie?
And we are all
going to
be
happening.
Bent the fuck over.
Oh. It's going to be somewhere really improbable, like the New Statesman.
I know. I'm just waiting for it. I'm ready for it.
What's happening with Maggie? What's wrong with Maggie? What's wrong with Maggie? They'll have a cutout of Appleton in that brown jacket.
What's the matter with Maggie's?
What's the matter with Maggie's?
It's interesting as well that, like, one of our favourite scenes of Runaway Bride is Joan Cusack. I can't even remember. I mean, that says everything that I can't remember what the best
Peggy
friend.
Fleming, not the ice skater.
Peggy.
Yeah.
That Peggy, when Peggy says to Maggie, when Ike gets in Maggie's head and says, you're inappropriate with your best friend's husband.
I love that whole section of the movie.
It's so powerful.
Yeah.
And there's this bit where I think it's so believable in friendships where you've grown up forever that there are, in every really, really long-term friendship, I think there is just one thing you accept about that person. And you speak to other friends or you do therapy or whatever. You do whatever you have to do that means that you never bring it to them and you never confront them because it's so a fundamental part of who they are. And the examples of how much it has hurt you or annoyed you since you were 11 years old is so extensive and expansive. How do you even begin to go back to the beginning of that?
Yeah.
So you know when she says, when Maggie finally has this realization that, like, perhaps she is inappropriate with the way she relates to men and her friend's partner. She says, "Do you think that I flirt with Corey?" And there's this like serenity where she's like, "Yeah, you do." And it's like hurtful, but you don't mean to hurt me, and I understand. I just think it's such a believable long friendship,
so perfect
confrontation.
I remember so clearly when I was watching that, like hungover on a Saturday, whatever, and being like, oh, I'll throw on this 90s movie that I have like warm feelings towards, and like, we've got the journalist and he is a bit creepy, he's falling around. And then that scene between those two women, and it's like, I remember watching it the whole time, like, oh, I'm afraid they're going to cut it off soon. Like,
yeah.
Because generally scenes like that have to be so short.
No, it's really slow and
beautiful.
It's
so slow, and they're just in the closed hairdresser and just sitting in the chairs and having this real conversation about, like, what a really long friendship with somebody who looks like Julia Roberts feels like.
Yeah, you feel the pain of her so much from Peggy.
But she loves her so much.
Yeah. And you know she's just made her peace with it. This is who my friend is. This is how men feel about her. And actually, it's kind of a conversation with the casting. Because as we've just said, what is this quality about Julia Roberts that makes her literally like fortify movies, hold up entire movies? It's kind of the conversation they have in the hairdresser.
Yeah.
And she says, there is something about you that, you know, I can't ever emulate.
Yeah.
And she says, you're quirky. And what does she say? She says, you're quirky and I'm just weird. Or the things that you pull off as being like mysterious and effortless on me, your dorky best friend Peggy, is strange and unbecoming.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so heartbreaking.
It's really hot. But it's like, it's the way that Joan Cusack delivers it.
Mm.
It's just so good. It's just like you can tell this woman has just like made her peace with it.
Yeah.
There was probably a period 10 years ago where she was talking about it a lot.
Yeah. Like what the fuck was Maggie like as a bridesmaid at that wedding?
Oh my God, what the nightmare. Fuck was she like? But that speech went on forever. And and like, she's like, I think you're a mystery to you.
Yeah.
Is something
she
says. And I think you have all this sort of like energy that just like floods out on anything male that moves. And then, great line. Julia is like, oh, as opposed to men who can't move. And Turkey's like, well, certain kinds of coral, you know.
But it's interesting as well. Like, I think we all have women in our lives who that is how they relate to men.
Yeah.
And they're not aware
that that's how they relate to men. Yeah. But the only way they know how to connect with someone of the opposite sex is by knowing on some level deep down that that person wants to fuck them. And it's not manipulative. And as Peggy says, like, Maggie's not even aware of it.
No.
But it's like...
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's so, and she says to her in this really compassionate way, like, it doesn't annoy me, but like, I want you to know what real commitment is and really being known by someone and really knowing them, like, rather than having this like spreading your attention so thinly across things to feel this, like, you know, omnipresent attraction from everyone.
And is Maggie in the room with us right now?
Why do I look like Joan Cusack, but I've got Maggie's problems?
You're my Julia Roberts. Things that you do that are mysterious and wonderful are fucking weird on me.
I love you. That's so not true, but I love you. I mean, do you know what? I do think I've always been really interested by that character. And something that I am really interested in her is that, like, commitment phobia thing. Because that's something that I've, like, spent the pounds in Thesa talking about over the years.
Did you say spent the pounds in Thesa in relation to your going to therapy?
I've made it rain
in pounds in Thesa.
I've made it rain in Thesa talking about commitment phobia.
Actually, I have a thing. Yeah, this is I've never told you this.
Go on.
This is a new one. Might cut it out, might leave it in. Who knows?
Go on. We're being incredibly
I don't care.
Do you know why I don't care? I don't think a lot of people are going to listen to this one because most people don't like this film. So I'm just like ready to tell everyone everything.
Yeah.
Go on,
exactly.
Tell me.
This is in relation to how you are the Maggie of my life. Which is, I was having a coffee with someone we both know.
Yeah.
Actually, you know her. That girl, Victoria, who lives near me.
Oh, yeah.
We had a coffee. She's lovely. Hello, Victoria, if you're listening.
Yeah.
And we were talking about, like, she's known you for years. And she was like, she has something about Dolly. Just, she's always in these, like, really magical situations. And I can't really account for it. And I was like, I know. It would be annoying if she wasn't so great. And then I remember saying, I was trying to piece it together in real time. I was like, I think she just sees the world as being very magical, and then it sort of behaves that way to her, and it's like an optimism that is mirrored back, and it's kind of amazing. And she was like, yeah, that kind of, yeah.
Oh, that's so beautiful. I thought you were going to say, you know, she does exaggerate stories. That's a lovely thing to say. That's a nice way to spin it. No, you don't think it is lovely. I take that as a great compliment.
No, it's like, I'm just feel embarrassed for telling you now.
No, I think that's, I mean, yeah, I think the thing that's so interesting with, like, someone who's like constantly looking for new stories and new versions of themselves that they can be, is it is, going back to Maggie Carpenter, I think the problem is that she
there's something like commitment phobia is such an interesting thing. I think people wrongly think that it's being terrified of intimacy. I think they're all like being terrified of being hurt. I do think that is, there is an element of that, or being terrified of just like missing out on opportunities.
Yes, I think
and
that,
fun.
That's the chief thing is people like, you just don't want to like, yeah, close the door on any new opportunities.
Yeah.
And therefore it's that Sylvia Plath thing of letting the figs rot away on the tree.
Yeah, exactly. Nearly got a bloody fig on my tattooed on me. Thank Christ I didn't.
Thank God.
There are so many tattoos that didn't happen.
Yeah.
Joni Mitchell, line from Cactus Tree, while she was busy being free.
No.
Well, she's going
to
get...
Never get a tattoo that could be sourced to brainyquote.com.
Quora.
Quora!
I wanted to have busy being free, and then I decided it sounded like a WhatsApp status. At the movies. But I think that there's definitely something existential about commitment phobia, which is... Maggie is someone who is multidimensional. She's kind of like a Zelig. Like, she can make everyone fall in love with her. She can be like... She can be down with the boys. She can be one of the girls. Mm. Old ladies think she's adorable. Everyone thinks she's adorable. Mm. So, like, to commit to one person, and all these different men are like archetypes, like the sporty guy, the religious guy, the rock and roll guy. All these different. Oh, I have a theory about you with those guys, by the way, that I'll return to.
Okay.
And it's like she's trying on all these different types of Maggie of who she is. And actually, the thing that frightens her is like she sees committing to one would mean committing to a final version of herself.
Yes.
And that's the thing that's over. And actually what she doesn't realise is something that you've taught me, a healthy understanding of commitment is that you are not signing off and handing in some final version. You're not frozen in amber as the person you are on the first date with that person. Like you grow together.
Yeah.
That's how you get over commitment phobia.
Yeah. It's the something I always think about, a Marion Keyes quote where she was talking to a magazine about her very long marriage.
Mm. And I know exactly what interview that is.
Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah.
She's so fucking smart. Saying the trick to having a really long marriage, I think she's been with her partner for like 20 years or something, is that it is many little marriages. Mm. And I find that to be so true. Like I've been with Gav going on almost 10 years, you know, and I sometimes come across an email or a WhatsApp or a letter or a birthday card that one of us gave to each other. And I look at it and I think that, oh, that's an entirely different way that we used to communicate. Mm. And that it was 4 years ago. Different pet names, different memes, different jokes, different, you know, style.
Rituals.
Yeah. And it just...
That's how you hack it.
That's how you hack it. You just keep changing and hope you change together. And
yeah.
Sometimes you don't. Like,
so yeah, here's my theory about all the men. Okay. So you know how we were like discussing yesterday which is the most realistic wedding that we would have had, like which is one of those.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So I was thinking about it. Mm. I was like, could I see Caroline with the rock star, or the geeky bug guy, funny geeky bug guy, or the like really adoring man who then became a man of the cloth, or Ike. I think you could have been with all of them. They sound like all your ex-boyfriends.
Oh my God.
I feel like it's a cross-section of everyone you've ever slept with.
Oh my God.
Don't you think that's true?
That's so true.
Like the guy who's obsessed with you is really calm and like a little bit boring, the really dangerous rock star guy, the geeky bug guy who's like funny and quirky and a bit too online, and then the like cynical writer guy.
Yeah No, you're
it's like
right,
potted history of your carnal history.
Yeah. God, I guess there's a little bit of Maggie Carpenter in all of us, isn't there? Yeah, no, you're totally right. This is something I've like referred to on the podcast a few times before, but like definitely I was a real serial monogamist from a really young age, and I was very like that. I think maybe that's why I've responded to this movie so much.
Yeah.
I do get the thing of like being like meeting someone and being fascinated by their strangeness and them being like sort of different to everyone you've ever known. And yeah, being a geeky bug guy or like being like a metaler or whatever.
Yeah.
And being really entranced by that, and also having a kind of a writer or journalistic-y type brain where you just want to know everything. You're like, tell why bugs? Why? Kind of thing. And then slowly merging into that. Like I was thinking about this the other day, where when I first moved here when I was 21 and very quickly got into a relationship, even though I don't regret the relationship because it was so lovely and I really needed it at the time, there was these friends that I made at that time who I was living with. It was like a quick friendship. It was like a situation where like, oh, you know, we're all vaguely know each other and we need a rental house. And then we got the rental and it was lovely and they were two incredible people. And I'm not in touch with them anymore, other than like following them on Instagram, because I just submerged into that relationship because it was like this protective blanket over what was like a very scary and new situation.
Yeah.
And I don't regret anything that happened next, I do wonder about that other path of like, there's a world in which I am really good friends with those two people still, the way they are really good friends with each other, you know?
Well, look, you'd be forgiven for it because I think the reason why it feels so recognisable in this story, and it's why it's annoying that it was an afterthought rather than the thing that drove the entire fucking premise of why this woman keep running, is that being swallowed up by a relationship and a man's identity, I mean, it's so instinctive and it's so culturally conditioned with women to do it. Like, I still see women do it now. I think I'm still prone to do it. Give me the right / wrong man and I think I could totally do that. Again,
God, it's funny because
I don't ever feel fully immunized from it, from that behavior.
And maybe that's good, right? Maybe there's like a sense of like, it's nice that there's a romantic left in all of us kind of thing, and that you can just fall into just this world where you never get out of bed and you're just obsessed with each other for a bit. But
it does happen. I mean, I think like every woman should be forgiven for that. I still get so many letters from girls saying like, my friend has become her boyfriend. Yeah. My friend has disappeared. And I'm just like, I'd give her for like 5 years. I'd give her a few years. Like a
few years?
Yeah.
That's so kind.
Yeah. And the good ones that come back.
Yeah.
It's such a common thing. Luckily, you get most of it out of your way in your 20s.
That's true. I'm interested in that first round of divorce that comes around and then people have their post-divorce first relationship.
Oh, yeah. What will that be like?
Yeah. Well, we'll see. We're getting way off the film. But
let's go back to this film.
This film that we're ostensibly here to talk about. My favourite scene in the whole movie is the luau.
So good.
So they've been seeding that, like, you know... Maggie and Ike, she's sort of letting him in more because she thinks if I let him sort of follow me around and answer him honestly, then I'll have more control over what happens in this story. And he sort of sees what her real life actually is. And her real life is that, she was supposed to go to Princeton, I think, and then her mother died and she couldn't leave her father alone. And so, you know, all this untapped potential just sort of goes into this pursuing of romance, which I think, again, I would love to rewrite this movie and just delve into that for a while. Like, that is so interesting to me.
That's the loveliest, now you've said it, that is the loveliest section of the film.
Yeah.
And the most like meaty is that bit when she decides to let him in.
Yeah, exactly.
You're so right. It's so good, that bit.
And it's because she's being treated like a source that she allows a level of vulnerability that she can't with the men in her life who are actual...
Exactly.
Romantic partners. And, you know, they have this thing where they like go and pick up her dad who's a drunk and, you know, he leaves him to pass out in the car and she's just... You can see this thing that comes over her. She's like, please don't.
Oh, it's so
please
sad.
Please don't lie about any of this, you know. And it's... Oh, it's really sad. But then, so he's seeing her life and this world that is very, it looks idyllic, but it's flawed and people aren't very nice to her, you know? And
that's the problem with when you grow up in a town and you never leave, is that you will always have a joke that you're the butt of.
Yeah.
Like, it looks so cozy from the outside, as you said, they are a tight-knit community, but it is claustrophobic.
It is definitely, obviously, like the Sweet Home Alabamas or whatever, like this small town life in rom-coms is something that gets returned to a lot. It's very rich fodder. And I think this is like a very balanced view of what it truly is. Like, you can be around people who have loved you your whole life and love you who you are. And they can also be fucking mean to you.
Yeah.
And it's claustrophobic and they're watching what you do. And both of those sides feel very fairly represented. When it gets to this part in the luau where... they're going over these jokes that we've heard a million times in the movie already. And it's already exhausting to us, the viewer. And where it's like, oh, Maggie may not be our longest running joke, but she's certainly the fastest. And may the pitter patter of little feet not be Maggie's. And then Ike does a toast, and I just love it so much. He says, to Maggie's friends and family, may you find yourselves forever the butt of an easy joke, or like, may your noses be forever rubbed in your mistakes, kind of thing. And it's this interesting thing of like, who gets to be made fun of, you know? And it's like, these are very flawed people around her, her dad with a drinking problem, all this kind of stuff. And but like, that's sort of untouchable and untouched. But it's okay to make fun of Maggie. And it's the first time you've seen anyone really stand up for her, or stand up for anyone in a film.
Yeah.
I've never seen a rom-com where like, defending a woman against the systematically terrible behaviour in her life,
rather than defending her like in Pretty Woman from another man's advances, or from
a snotty sales girl, you know?
Yeah, you're so right in that. Like, I remember you saying to me once about that scene, you were like, it's so powerful because it's every woman's dream, and every woman's dream is not for a man. I'd enjoy a bloke beating up another bloke, in my honour.
Yeah,
I gotta say, I'm still waiting for the day for that to happen. I don't think it happens anymore. But really, what you really want is, you want someone, whether it's like in difficult moments with your family or your friends, or like at work, you know, the moments that I have felt like, God, it would, to have a hero next to me now, like to, a best friend, to just say, you do not understand her like I understand her. It is like every woman's dream to have someone defend your character rather than
your
body or your honor or your femininity or something.
You're right. That's what's so magic about it, because it is such a played out thing of being like, oh, this sleazy guy is cornering the woman, and then the guy gets to have this big moment.
Yeah.
But it's so much. And like, I've had boyfriends in the past say like, that is every man's fantasy. It's not every woman's fantasy. It's every man's fantasy.
Yeah.
To sort of defend his girlfriend's honor. So I think its existence in culture is more to do with that than to do with women. But yeah, like, because I think women's characters are so constantly judged and scrutinized all the time. And Julia Roberts is one of them, you know, and it's probably was probably her fantasy, you know, like, like the idea of, you know, that Ike character is not just saying it to her friends and family. They're saying it to everybody in that cinema screening, hopefully.
Yeah,
totally. Yeah, this is a young woman who made mistakes, but how dare you, you know?
Did a woman write this script?
Two women wrote this script.
That makes so much sense to me, because we also identified that Maggie Carpenter is the first cool girl who I really want to be.
Yes.
She's the perfect cool girl. In there are cool girls everywhere, but in stories that are mainly lensed by men. Mm-hmm. Whereas this cool girl, she is friends with all her ex-boyfriends, which is a very particularly like female cool girl desire. Mm-hmm. She is like beautiful and sexy in a way that is entirely natural, never wears a scratch of makeup, always wearing big boots and big jumpers. She has loads of female friends who love her.
Yes. She's a girl's girl.
Yeah.
First and foremost.
Yeah.
And that's really important.
And she's like a little bit slutty, but she doesn't get in trouble for it.
Yeah. That is the perfect
It's the perfect cool girl.
Yeah.
I can so see that a woman wrote the script.
Yeah. And I like thinking about it being two women, because and they both went on to be writers and executive producers of Desperate Housewives.
Really?
It makes sense to me. It's like small town cloistered thing.
Yeah.
Women's lives. I like the idea of, like, this is my headcanon fantasy. These two women, who at that point hadn't done a heck of a lot, sitting down, like, getting, like, in a probably an LA restaurant all day, just keep ordering glass of, and then being like, all right, what do you think is the deal with Julia Roberts? What do you think? Come on, let's really think about it. What do you think? I can really imagine us doing that.
Because I was about to say,
someone paying us like 20,000 quid.
That is my life in my 50s. You have just summed up exactly how I see myself spending it. Sitting with you, talking shit in a restaurant and writing five lines on Final Draft. Interestingly, I remember hearing a rumour that this story was engineered as a comeback vehicle for Richard Gere and Julia Roberts. Oh. That's not true. It was in development from 92. And the people that they had so many people on board for this project.
Oh, wow.
At one point, they had Ellen DeGeneres.
Oh.
And Mel Gibson.
As what?
Yeah. Sandra Bullock nearly did it.
Wow. You forget that before Ellen came out, there was like, she was kind of positioned as like a kind of TV's Meg Ryan a bit. She
yeah, I mean,
like,
I've got to say, I could kind of see her doing this part.
Yeah, back
that
then.
Like scrappy, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So it wasn't, I wonder how much they tailored, as you suggest, how much they tailored that script. Well, to those actors when they were signed on.
It also makes sense that it's because it was, you know, in development for years, that there were probably several versions of the script that then got changed and bolted and...
Yeah, she said no to the first time she read it. She
really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there are just scenes in it that are just so smart and so fulfilling as a viewer. And then you get to... So she has a rehearsal wedding at the chapel with her Annapurna boyfriend, and then she just walks down the aisle and just kisses Richard Gere.
Oh, it's so bad from
it's
there.
It's really bad, and it just tanks.
Yeah, it's like, and there's still a sizable chunk of the story left.
Yeah.
Which is like, well, let's break it down, because like, there are certain things that you allow in rom-com world.
Yeah.
Like, one of them is, and it does drive me insane, but like, characters being fine with their partner.
You hate this.
I think it's because I am so petty. And as you know, I cannot get over relationships for many decades. Mm-hmm. Whenever I remember getting over someone a couple of years ago and watching this movie and the mountaineer guy being like, seeing Richard Gere kiss his wife the night before his wedding.
Yeah.
And he's like, basically, okay, well, you guys should get married. And like storms off into a van. And I remember just being like very humiliated and angered, being like, why is he not upset about this? I get
and
it.
And then
it's
he
fine.
Comes to the wedding.
And then he comes to the wedding. I get it. It's like, you know, it's rom-com land. Also, the like marrying someone you don't know. Rom-com land.
So this is the thing. This is where it's all shonky and feels bolted together, a collection of bad hard drives. Where there's like a falling in love montage that happens after they decide to get married.
Why do you hate that montage?
I hate it. Because it's yet another like chapter from is it his girlfriend or his daughter? Because all the things they choose to do is like him pushing her in a swing, them playing cards together and her like freaking out when she wins like she's a toddler. Like,
yeah, which I referenced in the rom-com montage in my show episode 7. Sorry about
was
that.
Was it when they went to New York?
Yeah, I literally did. I put that in for that.
Well, that was nice when you did it. Anyway, but I hated
well, thank
it.
Thank you very much.
Well, I hated it when they did it. So...
What else? That montage is thin.
It's thin. And there's a few voicey bits where it's like, oh yeah, so I've always wanted to write a novel, so I'm going to live half the time here and half the time in New York, and that's what we're doing. Bye. And it's horrible music. The soundtrack of this movie is off the bloody
really?
Boil as well.
Yeah.
When it starts with that U2 song and her riding the horse at the very beginning. I hate that. And
that Miles Davis song is beautiful, but it's so bum out.
It's so bum out.
That soundtrack, do you know as well how much this movie they had for it? Oh. 70 million, which for a rom-com is like completely unprecedented.
Oh,
so much money. I don't really know where that money went.
Where
actors,
did it go?
Actors, I suppose.
Actors, horses. Then it's like a rush thing. I'm like, oh, now they're getting married. Yay. And then she runs from their wedding. He pursues her. They break up for a bit. Another montage. So we've got two incredibly long, very shit montages that are poorly scored within like a 10-minute chunk of screen time. And you're like, how am I? And then she like goes and discovers who she is, tries a bunch of eggs, sells her Designed by Mag lamps, which are hideous.
The hideous lamps.
There's this bouquet of light bulbs. And he walks around being demonstrably fine. And then she shows up at his flat being like, here are my shoes.
Yeah.
And it's pants.
It's so pants.
It's pants!
It's so the word for it. And also, like, there's something that you've got to be really careful with pacing and with when you're telling a story on screen is, like, we all know repetition, when done well, makes a joke funny. Like rule of three, you know, we know that that's something that like you bring the audience with you of, oh, we're referencing that thing again that we've got this journey we've gone on together comedically. Like here it is again. We're anticipating it. There's tension release. It's funny. There's like,
you've got to be so careful for, like, if you do it one too many times, you're like, oh, the joke is boring now. And we're not in on it. We are bored of it. And that's how I feel when she backs out of the aisle.
Yeah.
For that final time, I'm like, no, this, we're not in on this anymore. This is not funny. This is boring.
And also, I think it's because the premise of the movie is set up with, like, oh, and she runs and here's all the wedding videos. And it's, like, interesting, but it's what got us in. It's not what should get us out.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, we, at that point, we've had, like, an hour following this girl around of, like, seeing who her life, what her life is, who her friends are, what her dad is, like, you know, the, all this, this really quite emotionally raw for a rom-com experience of this character. And then, like, oh, there she goes. It's like, oh, I don't like it.
Yeah.
But, like, and then they get back together and then they get married again. And it's like, I understand if you have a movie called Runaway Bride that you have to, you, it begs for a kind of narrative symmetry that she should be, I guess, married by the end, I suppose.
But look at Four Weddings and a Funeral. The first draft of that movie was going to be five weddings, a funeral and a honeymoon.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So they were going to get married and then they were, there was like an epilogue to the story of them being on honeymoon. Huh. And they correctly decided that that was not the synchronicity that was needed.
Yeah. No, you're right. Like, how would you have ended this movie? How would we have ended this movie when they give us money to rewrite it?
Oh, I'd love that. Netflix are doing that a lot with rom-coms at the moment.
I know. I think we could do it.
No shit. I would... Oh, God, it's so hard to find a way of not marrying. Like, Four Weddings and Funeral is actually quite an interesting parallel.
Mm. I hadn't thought of that, but you're dead right. Yeah.
The absence of a wedding, of like, at the end, of like... this feels like it causes too much trouble for everyone.
Yeah.
How do you feel about not being married for the rest of our lives?
Yeah.
Like, they have to fucking pour down with fake rain. Like, they had to do so much to make that moment feel climactic. Like, they're kissing in the rain. She still says, I do. They like, that's how you make it feel like the same sort of climax, earned climax as a wedding. So I suppose you would have to do your own version of that.
You would. You're
and
so
I don't
right.
know what that would be without entirely ripping off that ending. It, do you know what it would be? It would then be them running away together. It would have been them looking at each other at the end of the aisle. And then they both get on horseback and then they run
and
away.
And they're both like, no, this is not.
No, this is not who we are.
Yeah.
Let's be,
that's
let's
a
be,
better
yeah,
ending.
Let's be tearaways together. Yeah. And then you get that amazing shot of them on the, through the fields of the sun at the end. What would you do? That score is pants. I'm really going to reuse that word a lot now. It is pants.
There's a horrible song. What's that song? When he's sad, we're like, oh, you made my the green eyes blue song. Do you know that song? It's horrible.
I don't remember any of the songs.
It really stuck out this time for me. I don't know. Maybe this is my third time watching it in 1 year.
Why can we not stop watching it?
I don't know.
I might watch it again tonight. Okay, can we talk really quickly about why you won't go to Berlin, Maryland with
me? Oh, yeah, because we did. Thank you for... a great disagreement in our relationship is around...
I found the Airbnbs. Sorry.
Do you want to introduce this?
No, you go on. Go on.
Okay, it came from this. You wanted to go visit the town, and I said no.
Not only did I want to visit, in my head I've got a wish list, Airbnb wish list of Berlin, Maryland place. On that main strip we could go to, we could visit all the little places. There are tours that they do, that there's like, you know, it's really commemorated there. And I thought I could do it for you as a pre-wedding present.
What?
I thought I could
think
book
of
it.
All the places we would go. We could go all the places in the world.
But you had a very bad reaction to it.
I didn't realize that you were going to buy it as a present.
I thought it would be fun because you're getting married and it's Runaway Bride. But actually, I realized it would just be fun for me. Like, I actually just, like, when I was thinking about making you stand, like, you know, like outside,
like that time you took me to Leon Cohen's house.
You were so down in the dumps about it. But there's something about, for me, it's like you don't. And then I found the Spice World bus on Airbnb in the Isle of Wight. I'm not getting you there either.
Yeah, I think I just left you unread with that one.
What is this? Because you and I both are obsessive, geeky fans, but there's this interesting strain that differs us of like, I will not feel like my love and fandom is complete until I have visited somewhere or purchased something.
Yeah. And I think you should have a word with yourself. No. So my thing is that, do you know what I feel really bad about actually? And I've been beating myself up.
The Joan Didion desk.
Yeah, I do.
You lost your lid at me about that.
I know.
You were livid.
I feel really bad about this. I'm really sorry.
Well, don't worry. That desk went for a lot more than 500 quid in the end. So I didn't get it.
Dolly was going to buy Joan Didion's writing desk in an estate sale, and I, for some reason, freaked out at her. For reasons I don't totally understand.
I do understand, and actually, I think you should make your point because I think it's very smart.
Okay. It's weird because so much of me creating this podcast in the first place is not because I'm not a snob. I am a snob. I am a natural snob, and making this podcast is about me going to therapy every week. This is me dismantling my own cultural snobbery.
So true.
I'm so capable of it. I do it all the time. There are choices that people make in my life about and around culture that I'm like, just get a load of this, you know, or whatever. Yeah. And I hate myself every time I do it. I hate every single time my personality falls into cynicism or irony or holding something apart from me, because I'm always happiest when I talk and feel the way I talk and feel on this podcast, which is just like jubilant, just loving things for what they are and what they bring up in me and loving those emotions. And I really hate memorabilia. I hate memorabilia. I hate...
I'm so glad I know this about you, because I can so see for your like 35th birthday or like some landmark birthday, me like saving up and getting you some... The sort of thing that would make me go wild, like...
Yeah.
I don't know, Jerry Halliwell's t-shirt or something. I don't know.
Jerry Halliwell's t-shirt.
But I'm so glad I know that about you, because I know to veer so far away from it now.
And I think what I don't like about it is, I think just like, this is something I texted you last night when we were having this discussion, so I'm not going to pretend like I just came up with it now. I hate the idea that your heart and your brain isn't a big enough container for all your love of something.
Yeah.
I hate the idea that someone can buy their way into and colonize loving something more because they like own Elvis's guitar.
Yeah.
I find that greedy. I find it like you're associating sort of love and passion with capitalism and things, and I think those two things are antithetical. Not always, obviously. I went to fucking ABBA Voyage. Do you know what I mean? I paid 70 quid to go to ABBA Voyage.
Like, I know.
I love engaging with the past that way. But, you know.
I note with interest that Caroline and I are talking about a potential New York trip together soon. Yeah. And I note with interest that this big theory of yours does not extend to the Sex and the City Open Top bus tour, which you seem very excited to go on.
Yeah, that feels different somehow.
You're not going to chicken out on that on ethical grounds. Don't make me go on that on my own.
No. That's it. Because do you know what that is? That's a day out.
Yeah.
That's a bloody day out, you know. Yeah.
But we won't be staying in the Carrie Bradshaw apartment. That was too much even for me.
No. Yeah. I don't like that.
I don't like that at all.
And do you know what's the worst about that? I think Airbnb have basically done that as a press thing. And that's, again, it's like I don't like the love and emotion and truly having a relationship with a piece of art that brings up things in yourself, and then being like, oh, and now Airbnb has remade Carrie's apartment sort of like shelf for shelf, and it's like, no, that's wrong.
Yeah
It exists in my brain.
Okay, so pre-wedding present, I'm gonna find something else other than us going to Berlin. To be fair, I do think we'd get
go to Berlin, Germany.
I do think we'd get there and be like, wow, this is the scene where this is that. And then it would be over in an hour, and then we'd be stuck in Baltimore. To be fair,
there's no runaway bride open top bus tour. There certainly is not.
Is there anything else you want to talk about with this silly movie?
I'm glad we finally got to the end of our memorabilia conversation, though, because I did feel really bad about the Joan Didion thing.
I felt very silly.
I felt really mean. And like the worst part of myself was coming out, the cynical, shitty part that I try and cure with this podcast.
Well, thank you for saying that. And luckily, I didn't get the desk. So you don't have to be polite about it when you come around to my flat.
Oh yeah, I had my doubts, but it looks really good there. Oh yeah. Why did you need the desk, do you think?
Why?
So basically, prove me wrong.
I think, oh, that's such a good question. I've actually never thought about why. I think I'm naturally a hoarder. So I have boxes and boxes. Do you remember when you house-sitted my flat?
Yeah.
And you were looking for something. I think I needed my passport or something.
I was probably having a poke around, to be honest.
You were having a poke around. And you said to me, I cannot believe how many cards you keep.
Yeah, yeah.
So every single card that has meant something to me, every cinema ticket, every I keep everything. I think I'm quite interested in this idea of what you may call capitalism, the externalization of essence or something.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, what does the things that I love the most, how do I see them in front of me?
Yeah.
How do I externalize the most precious parts of my soul that go beyond I like this dress or yeah. I like this food or whatever? That feels like a very special thing for me. And that feels like, you know, there's like, I found out that a musician lived in my old flat.
Yes, I was going to bring this up actually, yeah.
I'm not going to go into it now because you know what? There is a 5,000 word essay waiting to be written. One day I will write. But a musician who I adored,
yeah.
I found out 4 years into living in my old flat in Camden that he lived and died there and lived there for 30 years. It was a very, very strange time of my life that you remember very well.
Yeah.
You said I was making you feel like
Joan Cusack. And this actually goes back to you know... We both identified Maggie Carpenter qualities in ourselves in this podcast. Mm. And this goes back to you being a Maggie Carpenter of my life of like, yeah, you do see the world in a very magical way sometimes that I feel borderline envious of because I'm not actually like that. I'm just not. And I've done that. I've gone to like houses where people I admired lived and I felt cold, you know. But like you, it's almost like you manifest these things. It's like you see the world and you're very romantic and magical person. And you just like you manifested this thing around you almost by virtue of being this way your whole life. It turned out the flat you lived in for like 7 years or whatever, this person that you really admired lived there and it couldn't, and you ended up having a relationship with their partner and everything, and you know, I'll leave the essay to granta.com or wherever you sell it, but I remember both feeling like Grub Street. I feel like it will be an American website.
Thanks,
but I remember feeling simultaneously like, oh, couldn't it happen to a nicer girl? like I'm so glad she's getting this little prize because she's been following, you know, little bits of memorabilia around the internet and around the world and going to...
And I was living in a piece of memorabilia, basically.
Yeah, yeah, and it was so beautiful. But at the same time, I did feel like the quirky best friend in the... Because I felt like it was my cue. Every time you tell me a new update about, like, you talked to the ex-girlfriend of the musician who is now dead, I'd be like, you're acting crazy.
You don't even sound like yourself anymore. No, it's the best friend in Serendipity. That's who it was.
Yeah.
Sarah, you're acting crazy.
I really resented it.
Will you go chase a bit of memorabilia? Find out who died in your flat. You don't want to. You're too busy.
I found out when I was going through my first big Mitford Sisters obsession.
Oh, yeah.
That I lived one street away from where Jessica Mitford
How did that make lived. You feel?
When I saw it, when I found out, excited.
Yeah.
And I was like, and because like, as well, that house is where, you know, she had been alienated from her family. They weren't speaking to her. She'd had a child. The child died of TB, like in this house. And I went round and I looked outside it and I felt nothing.
Yeah.
I just like, I waited to feel something that I don't think is just natural to me. Maybe it's a Taurus thing. I don't know.
No, I think it's just like a willingness to self-mythologize, which, as we know, I'm prone. I'm prone to do. But
a lot of books.
The widow of that musician.
Yeah.
Do you remember she came to the flat on my last night living there?
Yeah.
Again, so like I'm writing self-penned mythologies. It's like, this is the reason why all this shit happened. I do stir it all up.
You do stir it. You shake
I get all whipped up in it.
Yeah.
Carried away. And she gave me his lighter. And
yeah.
She said, I want your last cigarette in this flat. To be lit by him. And that's now like my...
That is two people who are really whipping themselves.
We were that day absolutely in a frenzy of whipping ourselves up. We were veritable meringues by the end. But that lighter that belonged to him is probably my most precious thing in my life.
Is it just like a Bic or?
Totally normal.
Oh, right.
Corner shop lighter.
Oh.
But there we go. So that's the main difference between you and I. And as differences go, I don't think it's going to be the end of us.
No, but it's interesting because it's like, I've realised now I could never write a memoir.
Yeah, I do not recommend it.
No. But like, I really admire, it's like, I think there's a cultural idea like, oh yeah, you just write down stuff that happens to you or whatever kind of thing. But it's like, it comes with a way of sort of seeing the world and a willingness.
Oh yeah.
That I don't have and I'm in awe of, you know, like.
Yeah, totally. It's like you have to have willful blindness in certain areas and willful attention in others to be able to shape it into something that is satisfying.
Yeah. But like, I think the thing is, this is so off topic, but when I zoom out, I'm like, oh, like two of the closest women in my life are both memoirists, like you and Ella. It's so interesting. So it's like, I get to appear in their work as like a figment of their romantic lives, but I don't have to do it myself. It's nice.
Yeah. Keep doing that.
Okay.
I love you. I wish you could do this every week.
Don't say that, they'll make us.
I do, but I just
like it.
I do just like it.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.